Fascinating discussion about chemtrails. William Thomas has been here since the beginning of the program. He's the author of Chemtrails Confirmed. Cliff Carnicom joined us an hour ago to add his perspective. And I appreciate that our guests recognize that there are some gaps in the evidence here. There's a lot of smoke, but not a lot of fire. They've been looking at circumstantial evidence and hints from government documents, things of that sort. But both admit we don't quite have a smoking gun bit of evidence yet. No definitive whistleblower who's come forward to talk about this. Maybe it's sort of like a sign of the times. We have a lot of uncertainty in our lives, a lot of suspicion, concerns about new world order, things of that sort. Government intentions not always being in the public's best interest. And if it is a sign of the times, if we live in an age of conspiracy, there are those who point the finger at the internet, that it is possibly fueled by the internet. And my guest coming on now is an expert in that field. His name is Mark Allen. He's one of the co-founders of AboveTopSecret.com, just about the largest conspiracy paranormal website in the world. Mark, you there?
Hi, George.
Hey, thanks for being with us. I hope you've been able to listen to some of the conversation so far.
I absolutely have, and it's been fascinating and enlightening, actually, and a lot better than I have to admit than I thought it was going to be.
Well, I think it's been pretty good too. Tell me this: you look at the big picture on Above Top Secret. You get all kinds of conspiracy theories. You get millions of people coming onto your site every month. Is there sort of a is it zeitgeist? Is it the sign of the times that people worry about conspiracies like this? And is it in part fueled by the internet, the engine that that pays your bills?
You know, I think it's interesting. It's a double-edged sword, the internet. For the first time in human history, all of us are able to talk to each other pretty much at the speed of, literally at the speed of light. So that's a very new thing. And I think that, the fact that everybody can talk to everybody, and when someone sees something or hears about something that doesn't make sense or doesn't add up, or better yet, conflicts with what they heard on the mainstream media or their government has told them, they're going to talk about it. And they're going to get a voice on AboveTopSecret.com that reaches out to millions of people. So the answer to your question is yes. I think that these things are definitely spurred on the internet. But I also think that there's a whole lot out there that we really do need to worry about, that we should be talking to each other about.
Agreed. Tell me this, on Above Top Secret, you get all kinds of topics discussed every day. The subject of chemtrails, I know, comes up. How often?
I just dug through those numbers today, surprisingly, because I knew we were going to be talking about them tonight. Interestingly enough, chemtrails represents about less than 1% of our traffic. So less than 1% of what the hundreds of thousands of members, registered members who provide content and speak up on the site through their posts are actually talking about chemtrails.
But it is ongoing, it is spirited.
It is absolutely ongoing, and those that do discuss it are very spirited, no question about it.
Do you have a position on chemtrails? Do you have a point of view?
I prefer to express what our members think for obvious reasons.
Well, what's the prevailing view among your members then?
The prevailing view among the membership is, if this was such a covert and dark and deep secret operation as it's, portrayed to be, there's one huge problem. Well, there's several huge problems, but the first major huge problem is you have no control over what you spray 38,000 feet up in the sky. So if you're trying to control people or make certain people sick, well, you're going to make your own people sick because you're squirting the stuff out at 38,000 feet. There's absolutely no control. I mean, the winds and everything else. And I would love to pose this question to the other guests. How do you account for that? You're spraying aerosols out at 38,000 feet or 30,000 feet or 40,000 feet. This stuff is going to go everywhere. I mean, the winds, I fly so much that I know that the winds are crazy up there, and the stuff's going to disperse everywhere. So what are you looking to gain out of this
I
without
think
killing your own family?
I think Cliff's answer to that, and Cliff, you can state it for yourself. Your answer to that is that the people spraying the stuff don't know what they're spraying.
People do their job. okay, in terms of at least the structure of a covert operation. People do their job. The whole need-to-know philosophy that's inherent in the design of the structure. What should they know, and what do they have the right to know?
Well, not so much the people spraying it, but the guys who ordered the spraying. Are they not going to worry about their family members, getting... And this is purely a question that's being asked by hundreds of thousands of people on this topic. So, the guy who pushes the button and says, okay, we're going to send this jet up 38,000 feet. We're going to spray barium into the air. We're going to spray this into the air. Is he not worried about his family breathing that in?
Did you want me to respond, George?
Sure, go ahead.
The first thing that one would need to do is identify the party that is managing the operation, party or parties, right? We're making possibly certain assumptions about what level that decision process is being made. I think that is a necessary question to answer before you even begin to answer the question of who's deciding what impact has whatever. You don't even have the parties identified. Number two, I would raise the question if somebody's saying you have no control. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. Number one, the first thing you would do is decide the scale of the operation. You have no control if you're trying to target a 5-mile area? Possibly, but even that's not necessarily the case. But the scale of the operation would be a partial answer as to whether or not you have control or not. There's no question that this is a global operation, and the scale of the operation should be considered as global, and the control issues should be also viewed as very potentially, very likely to be global in nature. Secondly, when you consider the possibility of the introduction of energy sources, and in particular directed energy sources, and you get into the electromagnetics of these operations, you allow for the potential of very direct, I hope we're still there, the phone dropped, but very, very direct control of energy transfer upon a specific location or a region. It's quite possible that it could be at a level of control that many of us would have a difficult time imagining. The third point I wanted to make, and this is, I'll try to keep it brief, but I do not regard the evidence that is available to us as being circumstantial at all. And I think those that say they wish to consider the evidence need to look at the physical observational analytical evidence, which is available, and evaluate that properly, and that it's not circumstantial at all. That would be my opinion.
Well, circumstantial in this sense is what I meant by that comment, Clifford, is that you have evidence, but the links between the physical evidence that you have and the planes is not necessarily always there. And the link then to diseases, for example, is not always there. But we're going to jump back into that. And I want to ask William Thomas, who had said at the beginning he felt it was an Air Force program, whether or not it has evolved into something else that other agencies or entities are involved. But we'll get into that after this break with our guests talking about chemtrails here on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us here on Coast to Coast to talk about chemtrails. William Thomas, in the beginning of the program, you talked about Air Force involvement in this. Has it expanded beyond that, do you think? Do you suspect?
No, they're the only ones capable. The U.S. Air Force is the only one with the aircraft that is hundreds of tanker planes available to carry out a program that's now been ongoing virtually every day for nearly 11 years. And I would say that alone rules out a deliberate biowarfare campaign. There's simply not enough biowarfare agents on this planet to fulfill even a fraction of such a mission. And I'm convinced that the only thing that would require nearly daily spraying for such a long time period would be this sunscreen application. I also agree with your guest that there is absolutely no control of these particles spread at altitude. And if you were deliberately targeting a segment of the population that did not include your top political leaders, military leaders, the managers and bankers who ran your society, you would use vaccines to deliver these targeted agents, not something like chemtrails.
Clifford, do you have any indication that this has gone beyond the Air Force, that maybe there's another entity directing it, intelligence agency of some sort?
Again, the parties are not identified, and what I do is look at the physical environmental evidence that's available to me. You know, the question of whether or not, let's call it the airplane, is the source, at one point almost becomes a moot point, okay? If you're looking at environmental change and effect, at some point, if the environment has been sufficiently changed and the deed is done, yes, you can spend our life trying to find out whether indeed it is the plane, okay, that is the source. But my contention is that we're far beyond the implications at this point of needing necessarily to have the final question answered and decided as to whether or not the aircraft is the ultimate source of the impact. The atmosphere of this planet has been changed. It has been physically changed. And if you don't think that's possible, it's quite possible because it's been done. 3/4 of the mass of the atmosphere is contained in a layer roughly 7 miles thick. The atmosphere of this planet is very fragile. And, you know, I've looked at this from a logistical standpoint, and it is possible to literally physically change the constitution of the atmosphere. And my claim is that it has been done. So that effect is there. Everyone can go through the evidence for themselves and decide whether or not they accept that proposition or not. But, you know, my work at this point is not at the level. I spent 3 years probably photographing airplanes, okay? I spent probably 5 years doing environmental sampling and analysis. For the past 3 years, I've been involved in biological aspects of this, and I have to say that I certainly do not agree that it is impossible to consider that biological operations of global scale have resulted or can result from operations of this nature. I would very definitely disagree with that.
And Mark, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And if we review the evidence as available, unfortunately, it's more than, let's say, a concern. It's more than a concern, the level of evidence that I'm talking about in terms of ubiquity and pervasiveness of the biological information and distribution. And each of us, if we actually get a little bit curious and start examining our own biology with some fairly simple tests, and it may be that many of us that are listening actually have a legitimate right to be asking some questions about their own biology.
Well, I would say we all have that right. Mark, Alan, I'm going back to you. The other kinds of concerns, you mentioned the first one that have been raised by ATS members. What are the others?
Well, you know, we took a look at the sampling that I believe Clifford did with the barium levels, and there were some issues there with the math. And playing devil's advocate myself, just a question straight up. Apparently, you guys took a vacuum cleaner that had a HEPA filter in it and pulled air in for about an hour. Was what I read on your site. And then you based the ratio on the total amount of particulate matter that the filter trapped without taking into account the volume of air that the vacuum cleaner took in. Is that correct, or am I misreading that?
Yeah, I do want to say good evening to you also, Mark. Thank you for the opportunity to meet you. I will say that it is apparent to me that the speaker has no awareness of any particular tests of that nature on my site. You will not find that specific test that is described on my site.
I apologize.
You guys, unfortunately, does not apply to me. My work is done almost entirely as an independent researcher. I have no affiliation with any group other than the nonprofit I have created. And you will find extensive, let's say, reports on my analysis of the barium issue, and they have absolutely no coincidence with the particular event that you're describing.
William, do you have barium stuff on your site? Could Mark be talking about you?
I do have barium stuff on my site and in my book, Chemtrails Confirmed, and I'm pointing to the state of California government study and statement saying that barium levels are significantly higher in that state in recent years, and they don't know why. I go that far. I like government sources, George.
I do too. That's what I was wondering, talking about something of this scale. There's atmospheric testing of all sorts all the time by different labs and scientists and agencies. I was wondering if something has popped up, if anyone has found something that shouldn't be there. Anyone?
I have spent probably 2 years working on the barium issue. I have probably written a half a dozen papers on that issue, and those tests are fully described. And the conclusions from those papers are also evident to anyone that wishes to read them. And the conclusion is that the existence of unusual levels of barium compounds in the atmosphere are very much a legitimate and reasonable concern based upon those tests.
Mark, anything to add?
Yeah, it was Clifford's site that I saw that on. I'm actually looking at it now, and that's interesting. Anyway, getting past that, the other thing that really intrigues our membership is it seems that the whole chemtrail phenomenon started about somewhere around 11 to 15 years ago. And if that's not a fair statement, I'm willing to expand that range to whatever needs to be expanded. And coincidentally, regional jet flights increased dramatically at the same, the same point in time. And if we looked, at the number of flights going across America, I happened to pull up for yesterday. There's 43,000 tracked commercial flights yesterday. On a Saturday, just over America, and those are the flights that are tracked publicly and easily available on the internet. So that excludes classified military flights and the obvious stuff that's not going to be tracked. So my question is, could there not be a correlation between people seeing these tremendous amounts of contrails in the sky, getting worried because they really did kind of all of a sudden appear in the sky? I mean, crosshatches and checkerboard patterns, which, if you really look at the flight paths, there's a pretty logical explanation for that stuff. There's flights literally checkerboarding the sky above America daily, 43,000 of them on a Saturday. And I'd just like to hear the guest's response to that.
William got into this a little bit. You touched on it briefly. You think you can account for the increase in the air traffic, right?
Absolutely. I think it's a valid point. It's a very strong point. But here's the answer to it, I believe. Not overnight. In two words, not overnight. Yes, a major increase in air traffic over years, even decades. Absolutely. But people were seeing these concentrated plumes literally overnight, from one day to the next, and they would go on, according to hundreds of reports in my files, they would go on for days, maybe a week, and then disappear, and then maybe reappear a month later and continue for weeks. That is not the sign of a scheduled airline route or routes. Many of these sightings took place away from omni-navigational beacons where airliners tend to congregate and crisscross. They took place in rural communities that were unused to seeing commercial traffic. I'm talking in one case out in Maine. St. Brent got involved and actually tracked down Deep Sky, our source, with air traffic control after she and her husband counted 25 jets in the space of about an hour, and they were used to seeing maybe one or two a day. She called up her radio station. The whole staff went outside. They counted 300 aircraft spreading these trails that afternoon. They never saw that again. So, no, these are sporadic and significant increases in aircraft trails, often over areas that are not regularly visited by this amount of traffic.
Fair enough. William Thomas, Clifford Carnicum, and Mark Allen are my guests talking about chemtrails. We'll be back with much more, and we'll be opening up the phone lines a little bit later for your questions and calls. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about chemtrails with my guests William Thomas, Cliff Carnicum, and Mark Allen. And there's one thing we have not yet touched on. It's the most controversial acronym maybe of all of them, and that's HARP. And I know that that acronym comes up in discussions of chemtrails. We haven't got into it yet, but we will right after this break on Coast to Coast AM. I want to get into the issue of HAARP because it comes up in association with all sorts of different conspiracy type topics. William, you're not going to be with us after the top of the hour, so I want to start with you. Do you think there's a HAARP connection to this?
I'm certain of that. I'm certain of that. Absolutely. Again, we have the scientists at Lawrence from Lawrence Livermore stating that very plainly that HAARP was involved. My own personal source that I've worked with for many years talked to me at length and in great detail about the use of HAARP and reactive chemicals sprayed in the air on the approach of Hurricane Katrina. And he asserts that it actually was used to turn that hurricane away from Texas and the Johnson Space Center. And unfortunately, it hit New Orleans with the consequences we've all seen. Interestingly enough, George, in my new edition of Chemtrails Confirmed, I have actual published graphs of the HAARP emanations showing dramatic and quite significant spikes. One when when Katrina made its landfall on Florida, and a second one as it approached the Louisiana coast. Very interesting information, as well as a description by a gentleman who interviewed many survivors of Hurricane Charley, who described physical symptoms, emotional and psychological symptoms that seemed to indicate they had been interfered with by electromagnetic radiation, possibly used to steer Charley and other hurricanes as well. I'm thinking of Hurricane Francis and Ivan in connection with something called Dynagel, a desiccant that was actually seen washing up on the shores outside of Palm Beach at that very time. So I think HAARP is implicated in chemtrails and in hurricane modification.
Clifford Carnicum, do you agree, or does HAARP show up in your research as well?
Absolutely, it does, quite extensively. My pathway to considering the issue of HAARP was not by assuming that HAARP was relevant and then finding information that coincided with that. It was exactly the opposite. My work followed a series of environmental sampling that led me to conclude the existence of a particular class of materials occurring in unusual and expected numbers. And that particular class of materials is what I referred to earlier as ionizable metallic salts. This does start to introduce the electromagnetic aspects of these operations, because an ionizable metallic salt is an interesting entity, and that is, you're talking about basically a particulate that has the ability to become electrically charged if it is subjected to sufficient energy. Two sources of energy that can be considered here would be, number one, the sun. It is actually possible with certain types of elements, particularly those in group two, group one and group two of the periodic table, to actually become electrically charged with the energy available within sunlight, particularly the ultraviolet spectrum. In addition, one could introduce energy into the atmosphere, and certainly HAARP, that's really what that place is about, is introducing energy via the magnetic field into the atmosphere. So my work, my path, was that of finding the existence of a particular class of materials and then asking the question, what application is consistent with the existence of those materials? What would you do with those types of materials? And that brings up the question of what's called, issue of what's called a plasma state. And, you know, many of us are familiar with the ionosphere, where you have a layer around the Earth that has a layer of charged particles. That is a plasma. A plasma is an electrically conductive gas. And my work indicates strongly that we must now open up to consideration the alteration of the atmosphere in general, and no longer can we restrict ourselves to the unusual properties of just the ionosphere when it comes to the propagation and transfer of energy. If you then ask what type of operation is consistent with a envelope, essentially, of an electrically conductive gas surrounding the Earth, HARP does come into play whether we like it or not. And it is at that point that I started to study the HARP patent. It's not exactly a bedtime reading, but and it was when I started out, but I have spent extensive time reading that patent. And what I can say is that the overlap and the coincidence between the physical principles and energy systems described within a particular patent. A patent is nothing more than an idea. It's not necessarily a deployment, but certainly this patent is completely consistent in all physical and energy considerations with the alteration of the atmosphere that has taken place.
Mark, I know that HARP shows up all over the place on your site. You had mentioned before that chemtrails as a topic is a pretty small one in the vast scope of various conspiracies. What about HARP, though?
HARP is huge. But to address the question at hand, the meteorologists who are obviously, you know, very interested in these topics, or they wouldn't be on AboveTopSecret.com, and the pilots who frequent our site, who have commented on both HARP and chemtrails, we just revert back to what I said moments ago, that if you wanted to conduct an experiment with HARP and you wanted to maximize or increase the effectiveness of HARP in the layers of the atmosphere, one of the worst ways you could do that would be to spray an aerosol from a jet at 38 or 58 or, 48,000 feet, because you have no control. And I would also like to add before William goes that, if you can bring up any of these radio station people that saw, the sky that you mentioned before the break, and I apologize for going back to something before the break, but I really want to get this in. AboveTopSecret.com, we have a news program, and, if you could present some folks that would step up and, just say that, and a group of them, multiple witnesses, we will be the biggest allies that you or these people have ever had. And that's really all we're asking for, is somebody step up, multiple witnesses, verifiable, pictures, anything, and we'll support you. And I just wanted to get that in before William left.
Well, I think we all agree with that, and William and Clifford have both addressed it before. It would be nice to have that. I guess it is what it is at this point.
We do have plenty of eyewitnesses, photographs, and videotape of people who have come forward. As I mentioned, some of them professionally trained observers, not involved with the program, but understanding that they were seeing something very unusual. And in terms of HARP, I might quickly add that I actually called up Dr. Bernard Eastland, the inventor of HARP. I caught him at his barbecue in Texas one afternoon, and I said, "What's the purpose of HARP? What was your intention in developing this apparatus?" And his immediate answer was weather modification. That was the primary purpose. There are many others, but that was the primary purpose, he told me, behind his invention that called HARP. Interestingly, that after I started writing about chemtrails for Environment News Service, Bernard Eason wrote me an email, and he said that the experiments I was describing seemed technically feasible, that is, using HARP and in conjunction with chemtrails. And he said that to heat up the atmosphere with HARP was very difficult. It would go right through the atmosphere unless you put some elements in that airspace that it could heat. And he suggested that polymers would work very well in allowing HARP to be directed to heat certain sections of the atmosphere. And, in fact, we've been seeing, as Clifford mentioned, cobweb-like material, polymer material all over the United States and other locations in conjunction with airplanes flying overhead, emitting something out of the back end of them. And Eastland went further, and he said that the heat generation occurs by adding magnetic iron oxide powder to the polymer. And that really got me going, because one of my very first stories on this subject, I interviewed a person in Tennessee, Mr. Farmer, who had worked with Raytheon Corporation, and he suggested that iron oxide was showing up in the chemtrails that he had analyzed. And Eastland finally said that two specific polymers, Freqion B20 and F5 PPS polymers, are sensitive to the 1 to 50 megahertz frequencies, and that HARP, he said, operates between 2 and 10 megahertz in that range. And he further noted that those polymers are made by a manufacturer in Ohio close to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which, of course, is in charge of the HARP program.
I understand that Mark and even myself were still a little bit what you would call skeptical, not hostile to this topic, but skeptical, asking questions about it. And that comes with the territory as a reporter for me.
Sure.
But I look back at the troubling thing for me in a larger sense, the historical precedents. You know, the idea that our government could spray something without our knowledge over the citizenry, potentially bad effects, seems preposterous on its face. And yet you look at the historical record, and there are programs where the government sprayed stuff on unwitting civilian populations as tests over the years. I would imagine, Clifford, that you've looked into that.
Look at the Senate hearings held in 1977 and acquire a document that is entitled Biological Testing Involving Human Subjects by the Department of Defense. This is a set of Senate hearings. That document's a little bit hard to get a hold of, but it's out there, U.S. Government Printing Office. In the past, apparently it's not available now, but it's out there. And this document is a record of Senate hearings that were held in 1977 that discussed in a public venue the very issue that George is referring to, and that is the disclosure in a public sense of the chronicle of aerosol tests as well, but in general, biological tests conducted upon the citizens of this country without their knowledge or consent. And so if someone does ask if there is a precedent for this issue, the answer is yes. And it actually dates back to the day that it could be done. If you had a means of doing it, and in particular, aircraft are suitable, you will find references to aerosol operations within this document. You will find references to the biowarfare military aspect in these documents. And the fact is they were done, and this is a case in 77 where we had the fortunate and rare opportunity to actually bring these to light, and those particular episodes were for decades preceding this, 77. Wasn't anything about something happening in 77. These were things that were brought to light from the 50s and the 60s. So you, even if you had the willingness and desire to hold public forums, you are, without any doubt, going to be dealing with a lag of often decades in terms of the type of information and technical capability of what it is you're even considering.
William, I don't have your book, Chemtrails Confirmed, but I would imagine you go into this, some of the examples of these kinds of testing programs on unsuspecting, unwitting civilian populations.
Absolutely. I was just adding that to my latest revision of the 2010 version of the book, be released by January 10th. And I do go into this. Clifford Carnegie is absolutely correct in citing this long-standing program that was completely covert and kept from the knowledge of the American public. And we have Gulf War illness, which I'm very well acquainted with, and the biological and chemical warfare that occurred in the Gulf. And that, too, was poo-pooed and denigrated by the U.S. government and other agencies for many years. And 10 years later, finally, they came out and admitted that this, in fact, had occurred. So maybe someday we will get an admission that chemtrails are real, are serious. And I want to emphasize that while I don't believe this is a intentional biological program for the reasons I stated, it absolutely, these particulates are absolutely making many people sick, killing people. Not intentionally, but the small particulate size we're talking about, 10 microns, has been cited by the EPA as an extreme human health hazard. Those are their words. And they say that if people inhale fine particulates, they were talking ground level pollution, but any kind of airborne particulate of this size, they are in grave trouble of heart problems, respiratory problems, allergies, and worse. from just the particulate size, let alone any possible toxicity. And finally, I'll note that I was concerned early on that these chemicals sprayed at altitude. And again, we have radar-confirmed sighting that this has been going on. We're bringing down to Earth viruses, bacteria, and fungi that live and breed in the upper atmosphere and are totally unknown, virtually unknown to the human immune system. And that if they were precipitated out of the air by so-called chemtrails, they would make people very ill indeed. And I was stunned to see that the scientists quoted by Bob Fedrakis in Columbus Alive at Wright-Patterson said without prompting that they were concerned that this very thing was happening, that these pathogens were being brought down to ground level. There are biological effects. They are serious. And as Clifford said, they are global.
Mark, you want to jump into that one? I mean, I would imagine that your membership, you and your membership, would be interested in the historical record of cases where government agencies have performed these kinds of heinous tests without the knowledge of private citizens and sometimes troops.
Without question. And we've looked deeply into the incidents mentioned. And from everything we can tell, it's absolutely true. But again, you know, these weren't dispersed at 38,000 feet. And I really hate to keep coming back to that. But all the science and all the professionals that I've personally talked to and all the people that have, you know, hundreds of thousands of them that post on the site, that continuously is the big hang up with the chemtrail thing, is you're up there in the way up in the atmosphere. The winds can cross. You've got the jet stream. You just have no control. But there's absolutely no doubt that the U.S. government has done some nefarious deeds in the past. No question about it. And that's one of the concerns that a lot of our membership has about focusing on, you know, 38,000 feet up in the sky and in the upper atmosphere where there's virtually no control based on meteorological science, that it's diverting attention away from things like what was just discussed. You know, real nefarious deeds done at very low level with crop dusters or, you know, allowing people to go into a space and pumping the HVAC system with aerosols. Those are terrible things.
Mark, can I jump in, please?
Sure.
Very important. I want to emphasize, Mark, chemtrails, after 11 years of investigation, I'm convinced chemtrails, the purpose is not, repeat, not, emphasize not biological warfare. There's not enough agents. And again, to do this so consistently over 11 years, I'm convinced the only possible reason to have to continuously spray this material is to maintain some kind of sky shield or sunscreen. But this is not a deliberate program to make people sick or cull the population. It certainly is a byproduct, an unintended consequence of spraying fine particulates that do make people sick. But I absolutely agree. There's no control and there's not enough agents to make this a continual biowarfare project.
Hey, Will, we have about a minute left in this segment before we take a break and William leaves us. Anything else to add, William, where the research goes from here?
Well, I just want to say that, again, after 11 years, we can say that these are chemicals. We have lab tests. I have actual lab tests in my possession of particulates falling through chemtrails being analyzed by private labs in Edmonton, Alberta, and Espanola, Ontario. It's in the book. It's on my website. We can say that there are chemical constituents, aluminum oxide in particular, barium, even quartz. We can also say that government officials in the FAA have confirmed, repeatedly confirmed, air traffic controllers have confirmed that these are Air Force tankers and they are spraying something that appears on their radar scopes. As far as where this is going, I am extremely concerned that given the dangers of small particulate inhalation and consequent health problems, the shift to nanoparticles by the U.S. Air Force in its weather control program will pose an urgent and extreme human health hazard, among other considerations.
William Thomas, we are glad you were here. I hope you're wrong. The book is called Chemtrails Confirmed, new version coming out in a couple of weeks.